So we're going to turn our attention for the next little while to chapter 65 of this book. And as you know, there's 66 books in the Bible, and Isaiah is sort of unique because it has 66 chapters. And as we pointed out at the beginning, our Old Testament is broken up into 39 Old Testament books, and our New Testament is 27. And we noted a discernible change in Isaiah in chapter 40, where there's been so much more talk about the Messiah. I don't make a whole lot of, case that that's supernatural or somehow. I find it intriguing anyway. And if nothing else, it reminds us of a way to remember how the book of Isaiah is broken up. It really is broken up into two chunks, this first 39 chapters, and is very much Old Testament law, and 40 through 66, which is very much New Testament grace and messianic. So chapter 65 is no different. If you remember over the last number of weeks, we've looked at these chapters, and Isaiah's been building what some people call a straw man argument. And a straw man argument is when you present this fictitious argument and you present, here's the one side, and boom, 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 and you lay out all of the arguments. And then in the flip side of the argument, the second side of the debate, someone just comes along and chops all the legs out from every one of those arguments all at once, and just they all fall apart. So in debate, we call that a straw man argument. And it seems like that's what Isaiah has been doing, because the people have been complaining, right? Where's God? Where's the God of the Old Testament? How come we can't find him? How come we can't see him? How come he's not manifesting his power? And in chapter 65, God responds. So he's about to cut down the arguments completely and fully. And he starts out exactly as you'd expect him to. I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. So in the New Testament, we have a word for that. What do we call that? God says, I'm blessing somebody who doesn't deserve it. It's grace, absolutely. So if you're looking for a definition, there it is. I revealed myself to those who did not ask me. In other words, it's not in our goodness that God has made himself known. I was found by those who did not seek me. To a nation that did not call on my name, I said, here I am, here am I. All day long I have held out my hands to an obstinate people who walk in ways not good, pursuing their own imaginations, a people who continually provoke me to my very face, offering sacrifices in gardens and burning incense on altars of bricks. So right off the bat, if you were to say, Israel's complaining, where's God? How come I don't see the God of the Old Testament? How is God responding? Give me his argument in sort of the modern vernacular. Yeah, so his name, Jehovah Shammah, S-H-A-M-M-A-H, I believe is the spelling, the God who is ever present. He's never not there. But the reason that the people are not seeing him, continually, right? They shake their fists. They say, I refuse. I don't want him. And that's sort of the interesting part is God, and it's often been said, God is a gentleman. He doesn't force himself into a situation that we don't want him to be part of. In other words, he willingly accepts our no. That may break his heart in a sense because he's being rejected, but he's willing to go with that. If we say, I don't want anything to do with the kingdom of God, God says, okay. Now, there's repercussions to that here and in the future, but he still allows us to say, okay. So, a couple of questions for you. Do you think God continues to reveal himself today? In other words, is he still Jehovah Shammah? And let me ask you this, if you could be as specific as you can for me then, how? Now, I know that we've talked about general revelation in the past, or natural revelation, some theologians call it, where God reveals himself through nature. You know, we look at the stars, we look at the surf, we see beauty, and we get a sense that there's a God. But is there any other ways today, and maybe this comes from your personal experience, I don't know, any other ways today that God has a way of revealing himself? Okay, so you've seen some very specific things in your life where you've prayed, God's answered, and you said, yep, clearly that's the Lord. Okay, and as I've shared with you on several occasions, I've shared it probably everywhere in Saskatoon now, you know, just the very fact when we were having Dine, and, you know, the woman comes in and prays for, you know, the unborn child in Carolyn's womb where nobody knew she was pregnant. I mean, that's a 2x4 to the back of the head for me, God saying, I'm here, I'm listening. You know, that's how our church found out that we were going to have a baby, when this prophetess comes in and told one of my board members anyway. Any other ways that he speaks to us? And any other ways that we can be specific here? Say, yeah, God really does speak today.
Speaks to us in dreams.
Okay, so there's been times in your life where there's been a specific dream that's spoken a message to you. You really sense that this was of the Lord. Okay. Yeah, I think too, as you said, to answers to prayer, he does, yeah. Does he ever work through circumstances and situations in which, you know, you're saying to yourself, well, this is clearly God. I mean, again, as I don't like going back to the same well, but moving to Saskatchewan, right? My resumes are out, nobody's answering, I'm 2 weeks away from being evicted. Well, I'm not evicted, I've gave notice on my apartment because I was going to leave. I'm staring at an atlas, staring at Saskatoon when the phone rings and it's a pastor from Saskatoon saying, we've been fasting and praying. We believe that it's God's will for you to come. I mean, I've never been to Saskatoon in my life and I'm staring at Saskatoon and the atlas as I'm talking to Brother Bridle on the phone and there's that connection. I mean, it's just, it was a circumstance I didn't even pray for, to be honest, because I was getting to the point I was a little bit scared and saying, well, I've been praying a long time for this. It's not happening. And boom, out of nowhere, it happens. Anything else? Any other ways that he may speak to us today? Yeah, well, it's intriguing to me when we speak about weather that, you know, I talk to a lot of Christians in my journey through life. And I oftentimes ask, you know, do you believe that God spoke to people through the weather in the Old Testament? Oh, yeah, you know, I believe the flood was, you know, pretty clear. And I believe Elijah and the drought for 3.5 years, that was clear. You know, the dream of Joseph. Yeah, God spoke. You know, so do you believe he does that today? Well, no, it's global warming. You know, it's interesting. And I'm not saying that it is or isn't global warming. I can't even tell you anymore from the evidence because I think the evidence is so convoluted that it's hard to tell. But whether global warming or global weather change is a human phenomenon or not, I don't know. But I do believe with all of my heart that God still speaks to us even through weather patterns. He's done it in the past. I have no reason to believe that he has changed. And, you know, my understanding of the New Testament, especially the prophetic side of the New Testament, is during the book of Revelation, he speaks again through weather. I mean, many of the things that are spoken of in the book of Revelation are weather or natural related. You know, from the destruction of grasses and fresh water to, you know, signs in the heavens. I mean, it's just, they seem to be very naturalistic.
I think if anything, it speaks about how little we are in control.
Yes. Well, I can't help but wonder if that's a whole part of this process, right? The weather seems to be getting worse on our planet globally, and we want to be able to control it. And so, you know, the philosophy is, well, we have to change our ways, and then we'll control it. Well, I'm not quite sure that that's true. Well, it's hard for me to draw the correlation completely, but I will say this. The psalmist says that to bless my people Israel, and I will bless you. I don't think that that promise has ever gone away. I think that Britain lost a blessing with the Balfour Declaration back in, you know, at the end of the war, where they appeared to have stood beside Israel and then at the last minute sort of turned away and said, no, something happened there, their empire. I'm speculating, but to watch the empire of Britain go from something that the sun never set upon to basically they're an island today. One can't help but wonder where the blessing of the Lord went there. And the United States, since that period of time, has seen unprecedented blessing, as has Canada. Until, of course, today, where the United States has now really turned its back on Israel, I think, almost antagonistically. In fact, I think as Canada, we almost stand alone today as supporters of Israel. So we will see what happens in the future. But on these global events, again, it's really easy for us to fall into the trap of saying, well, they're just, you know, we control them. If there's anything that you've pulled out of the book of Isaiah, understand that even though we feel like as governments and as powers, as, you know, technological people, that we're in control, we are not. And I think there's a very strong component in the book of Isaiah that says, hey, you know those Sennacherib and his armies that were coming in, the Assyrians, to take over Israel? Well, they didn't. And they didn't because God intervened. So if you pull nothing else out of that, understand that God is involved in the big picture. Not just in the intricacies of my life and your life, but in the intricacies of political dynamics. He's involved. He has always been involved. So do hope we draw that out. So does God continue to reveal himself today? I think the answer is yes. But let me ask you this. It's a second question. What kind of things make it easier or more difficult for God to speak to us? In other words, what do you see as a good conduit for God's expression into our lives? And what are things that may block the communication of God in our lives? Any thoughts on that? I mean, let's be positive first. What kind of things open up the channel so that God can more easily speak to us? So being in his word, right? There's no better standard by which to judge anything that we hear, whether it's what I teach or whether it's what comes across the newsreel, whether it's what we read in books or magazines, what we listen to. I mean, everything needs to come back to the word of God. So absolutely. That's one of those mechanisms by which God still speaks to us today, and I think we would all agree with that. He still speaks through his word. So in Carolyn's promptings, where the Spirit sometimes prompts us to do something, so often that prompting comes about as we're in the word, as we meditate on the word. So absolutely, there's a conduit by which God speaks. Anything else that opens up the channel? Okay, so when he does speak, we say, yes, Lord. As opposed to saying, no, Lord.
Well, even having, I think it starts even before that, to be humble before the Lord. Okay. We're proud. We can't hear.
Or we refuse to hear.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, I'll throw one up. Right. Absolutely, yep. How about silence? We are trying to convince our daughter that even though she believes with all of her heart that she is multitasking, that listening to music at the same time that she's studying or reading is not always a good thing. It's not a good combo. Because our brains are not wired to have too many sensory inputs at the same time. Right? We get overwhelmed. And then everything gets reduced. Is there value in setting aside, even if it's only a few minutes a day, of some silence before the Lord? Maybe it's prayer, maybe it's during prayer, maybe it's after prayer, just to be quiet and listen. I mean, I think that's a conduit, I think, that he can speak. And I'm not going to say that he doesn't shout and yell at us so that it sort of rises above the din of our life. But oftentimes it's in those moments of silence that we're quiet that I think God has an opportunity to whisper. And if we draw any truths out of that Elijah story, you know, up in the mountain of the Lord, it's in that small, quiet voice that God spoke to him. So even again, in our busyness, to take a moment or two to just to be silent. Any other conduits that sort of help us to open up? Sure, music is a powerful thing, isn't it? So maybe I could say it this way. Even setting a spiritual environment has value. And maybe that's Christian music for you. Maybe it, again, it's a silence time. Maybe it's things that you've placed around in your life that simply remind you of the presence of God. So whether it be a cross on the wall or a, you know, what would Jesus do thingy on your arm, anything that again, that snaps us back to that reality that reminds us that God is there, I think is a valuable thing. Okay, are there barriers to him communicating to us? Of course, the flip side of all those, right? Pride and arrogance. Never stopping, never slowing down to listen, never being in the Word certainly would be barriers. Anything else? Technology has always been a struggling thing because there's so much value to it, but there's also, with the value comes the great risk. You know, the old Spider-Man adage, with great responsibility, or great power comes great responsibility. So we've got all this powerful technology, but we have to be able to control it. To be able to say no, to be able to turn it off, to be able to move in a different direction, to live without it. And you're right. I think we're in a culture today in which it's easy to drone out pain and suffering and, you know, just the struggle of life by the constant din of noise. And somehow, I think sometimes that's where we live.
It doesn't even have to be just noise.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, so at that moment, in fact, it was, I heard that with, I don't know if it was Audubon, one of the guys who was talking at some point in time on porn. It says when a man so chooses to finally indulge in that, he may wrestle with it for weeks or months, and then he chooses, at that moment he chooses, God ceases to exist for him. It's not that God disappears, but it's this, he's made a choice, and the voice of God is now drowned out. So, absolutely. So I guess that the things that we're looking at here, and when we read about this, it is easy to say, well, God abandoned Israel, right? He left them to their own desires, and now they're struggling with the effects of that. But I think it's true of us, just in our own culture. It is possible for us to go down that road, and I think there's a warning here to just to make sure that in our own lives we've chosen, we've tried to work through, what are the things that are blocking God's voice, and how can I slowly but methodically remove those? Sort of allow the tap of the Lord, if you will, to come in more powerfully. I've thrown this picture up. It's a very, very common Christian phrase these days. I mean, over the years, it will disappear and it'll be replaced by something else. But I have this question again. One more thought on this. Why do you think of what you know of the wise man's story? How do they illustrate how we should be? What do they give us, in other words, in the New Testament that may help us? So I just want to look at the story briefly. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it. Jesus, of course, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and I'm in Matthew 2. So after he was born, probably up to, if the light in the sky was the sign of Jesus' being born, then the Magi saw it, they respond to it. Somewhere upwards of over the next 2 years, they make this journey. So they were not at Bethlehem's stable the night Jesus was born, although we love to compress the story of the Magi right in there, right? It's just all one big picture for us. The reality is it'd be upwards of 2 years later. So after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judah, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem. So again, Magi not being kings, but certainly being powerful scientists / astrologers. Okay, so the we three kings of Orient are, no, just not the picture that they weren't. They were as Daniel was 400, 500, 600 years before this scene. In fact, I would suggest to you, and I can't prove this, it's just a pet hobby of mine or a pet thought. I happen to believe that when Daniel was in Babylon, he became so instrumental in his teaching that somehow within that Eastern culture, he infiltrated the entire concept of the messianic coming. In other words, why would the wise men even know of this prophecy? Well, my guess is it was because of people, if not Daniel, people like Daniel, who were Jewish, who infiltrated the culture, and ultimately left an indent, their imprint, if you will. And 600 years later, it comes back because they know this prophecy. So we've got these magi from the east, somewhere from the east anyway. They come to Jerusalem. They ask, where's the one born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east. We've come to worship him. King Herod heard this. He was disturbed. Jerusalem with him. He called the people chief priests of the law and he said, where is the Christ supposed to be born? Well, they check out Micah 5 and 2 and they say, in Bethlehem. All right, so in Bethlehem in Judea, they said, and then they give this prophecy. So Herod calls the Magi secretly, found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. Now, that's important because he's about to kill babies. And he kills babies, how old? 2 years and under. So he inquires them, when did you see this light? Oh, we saw it 18 months ago or whatever, right? So Herod knows this in his mind. So he makes a little deal, go carefully search for the child. When you find him, report to me so that I may come and worship him too. Now Herod was Idumean from his birth, which means he comes from the Arab countries to the south and to the east of Jerusalem, or of Israel. He was very Greek in the way that he lived. That was his culture. He was very Roman in his politics. He was only Jewish by birth, if you could say that. He was part Jewish. And that you got to trace back to his grandfather. But, you know, without going there, he didn't know anything about it. And he's only being Jewish here because he's got to be with these Jews. So he's not a very Jewish man by any stretch of the imagination. But you know the story. They went. They had seen this star in the east, and again it appears to them and it goes before them and stops over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mouth as Mary. They bowed down, they worshipped him, they opened their treasures. And then having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by a different route. And that's all we know about them. Now, Isaiah we've already read where it says that they will come and bring great gifts to him. And this could be a partial fulfillment of that. But I do want to ask you, just briefly, is there anything we can learn from these wise men? And I want you to be fairly specific here if you can. What can we learn from them? Mm-hmm. So in other words, not just read them, but believe them. So when we read Old Testament prophecies, I think there's wisdom in saying, hey, you know something? I've seen hundreds, hundreds of these Old Testament prophecies in terms of who Christ is come to pass. We've seen them fulfilled in his ministry. I have no doubt that they're going to be finally fulfilled as well. So I actually believe them, and I think there's wisdom in that. And the wise men, they responded. They said, we believe this. There's this light in the sky. And whether it was a conjunction of planets or, you know, again, I tend to think that it was probably the Shekinah glory of God that was lit up the sky. That's my understanding. But you can have whatever interpretation there you want. And the only reason that I think that it was the Shekinah glory of God is because it appears again. They recognize that these wise men, the second time it appeared. Now, did it take them to Bethlehem? I actually don't think so. It is my contention, and again, take it for what it's worth, that instead of taking them to Bethlehem, it actually took them north to Nazareth. Because in the Gospel of Luke, it says that after Jesus, on the eighth day, was circumcised, his parents went home. They went back to Nazareth. Now, there's some scholars that would say, well, maybe they moved to Bethlehem after that, and that's possible. But if perchance they were living in Nazareth, and here's my question, of course, is why does the Shekinah glory or this star have to appear the second time to lead the wise men to Bethlehem? Bethlehem's 5 miles to the south. Everyone knew where Bethlehem was. And yet this appeared to them a second time and led them right to a house. Now, again, take it for what it's worth. Do understand this is upwards of a couple of years after the birth of Jesus. But it is my contention that it did lead them to Nazareth eventually. And it literally led them to a house. Now, why do I not believe that this light in the sky was a conjunction of planets? Because a conjunction of planets doesn't happen twice in 2 years. And a conjunction of planets will never lead you to a house. Now, again, there's lots of ways of looking at the text. I understand that. I'm just reading the text at face value. So it is my contention, take it for what it's worth, this is how I see the Christmas story, that on the night that Jesus was born, the entire sky lit up with this angelic realm. Correct? The shepherds saw it, they fell to the ground. It said that when the angel made the announcement to go and find this baby, you'll find him wrapped in swaddling clothes lying in a manger, and suddenly there was with the angels this beautiful, glowy, powerful, heavenly host, and they were all praising God. I happen to think, for whatever it's worth, that in that event, that it wasn't just local over a field, that it lit up the night sky. And I think it might have lit up the night sky for all night. I don't know. But in that light, in that power, in that display, I have no doubt to believe that that itself could be what the Magi saw. Again, I can't prove it. I'm just trying to put the pieces of Matthew and Luke's story together. But if I'm right, that's what they saw. They start out on their journey because, of course, the Old Testament has several prophecies about the Messiah coming and a star being the light that displays that. I mean, they knew it. They start on their journey. They go to Herod. Herod starts to send them to Bethlehem, but remember, the baby's already upwards of maybe 2 years old. So instead of going to Bethlehem, the glory of God appears again. And like it led the shepherds, it leads the wise men. And it leads them not to Bethlehem, maybe to Nazareth, but in Nazareth, wherever it is, leads them to the house that they find the Messiah. And when they find the Messiah, they worship. They present their gifts. Being spoken to in a dream, God still speaks in dreams, they say, we're not going back to Herod, because if we tell Herod about this, it's bad news. We go home a different way. Herod is enraged. His spies have somehow missed this group. And so he goes to the only place that he knows, and that's Bethlehem, where he slaughters babies. And at that point in time, Joseph gets a dream, and it says, get out of Israel, go to Egypt. And for the next number of years, perhaps, they will spend that time in Egypt until Herod the Great is dead, and they'll come home. And they'll settle in Nazareth again, because that's where he grows up. So one more time, aside from understanding and believing the scriptures, is there anything else the wise men can teach us? It would have not just been a costly journey, but a dangerous journey. Right? I mean, it's never easy to travel, especially in a big caravan like that. You're open season for thieves, and they're not carrying the cheapest of gifts. So you're absolutely right. Huh? It costs them something. Yeah, and consider this. They're going from the L.A., the New York of their culture, to the, Dalmany, Warman. You know, they're going from the powerful and the rich and the technologically astute down to the hick place, right? To the nobody knows that place. Why would a Messiah come out of there? So absolutely, that's huge for them. I mean, it's a step of faith that's just remarkable because they've come to believe that the baby is going to be born and this baby is going to change the world. And it's not coming out of some powerful place, not coming out of a rich palace. Anything else they can teach us? A couple more thoughts maybe that come out of this story. That even in the journey, there's wisdom in seeking the face of God. You know, once we're on the path God wants us to be on, there is great wisdom in still connecting with the Lord on this, right? Because even in the midst of their journey, they needed another dream to direct them, not back to Herod, but to go home a different way. They needed insight on the journey, not just to start it, but to finish it. And I think that speaks to me anyway about, Lord, every moment, every day, I need your wisdom. So that even if I know right now that I'm on your path, there may be some side roads you want me to take, and I don't want to miss them. So speak to me. The other thing that comes to my mind is the incredible provision of God. If God were to speak to you tomorrow and say, I want you to rise up and go to L.A. and live there for the next couple of years, and you were poor, how could you afford to go? And in this way, he does. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. You know, it's not like they kept this stuff on the shelf for the next 20, 30, 40 years, right? It's not like it became a god to them. What did they do with it? Well, they sold it. They needed to because they're poor. And they're now being asked to make this incredible journey to go live in another country. No house, no job. And you know, to be honest, the Egyptians really didn't look upon the Jews as particularly, you know, good workers, right? These were the Jews. And God provides for them. And miraculously, these are gifts that could have kept these people alive for years. And I think they did. And it's incredible to me to think that the simple provision where God says, Joseph, Mary, you're going to have to flee because Herod isn't going to let this thing go. That he provides for them in these gifts. So, it's a powerful, powerful part of this story. Any thoughts or questions before I move on? All the way back to the prophecies that Jacob would give on his deathbed. Joseph would give on his deathbed. No, that's not right. Forgive me. It's Jacob again. That's the first reference of the star and the power. But yeah, there's a number of them through Scripture. I can dig them out for you if you like. Any other questions? Okay, let's pick it up back in Isaiah 65 then, because I gotta move on here quickly. Chapter 65, again, God reveals himself in very powerful ways to these people. Yet there are people that provoke him. Down to verse 4. Who provokes him? Verse 3. Offer sacrifices in gardens, burning incense on altars of brick. We really don't know all of what this means. But it's clearly a pagan practice, and it's most likely a practice that comes from Babylon. Why is it interesting here that they make reference to making these altars of, brick? Can you remember back to the Old Testament commands about making altars?
Yeah, they were made out of brick.
Yeah, you remember what they were supposed to be made out of? Yeah, it was rock for sure, but it was unhewn rock, in fact. In other words, you didn't mold it, you didn't cut it, you fit it. You found the pieces that would fit together to make the altar. What's the difference?
God made them
man-made. In essence, that's exactly right. And it goes all the way back, I think, to the story of the Tower of Babel. Where the Tower of Babel, instead of being made of stone, of hard rock, is made out of this substitute, this clay with straw mixed in it, if you remember the story. And it's not that it's not strong, but it's man-made. And there's something in the scripture that's trying to point out, hey, don't think you can do this in your power, in your strength, and in your wisdom. And yet that's what they were doing. So this is where it makes reference to some kind of a pagan ritual of worship. And he goes on and he says, those who sit amongst the graves and spend their nights keeping secret vigils. What is this describing to you? I mean, it's a bad thing, right? What do you think it's describing? Absolutely. It was communication with the dead. That's exactly what it was going on. So people trying to commune with those that have died. You know, I've made reference to Ouija boards in the past, right? And I stand on this. I think that a Ouija board is a wicked thing, and it's something that I don't think we should ever be trying to play with, even if Milton Bradley does make it as a game or whoever makes it. It's a dangerous tool. It was based on a tool that had, you know, witches have used all the way back through, at least that I can trace back, the mid-1800s. As a tool to commune with the dead. And even if we slap a name on it and we make it a game and we make a movie about it, as has just come out again, I mean, this is something that Christians shouldn't be touching. And they shouldn't be touching this because we're specifically commanded, don't be looking to the dead for your answers. Be looking to the living, to God. And again, all the way through the Old Testament Levitical law, don't do this, don't go there. And the only person that we know for sure who tried, his name was Saul. And Saul comes to the witch of Endor and says, you know, I need to speak to Samuel. Samuel's dead. Well, conjure him up. Now, I won't get into the theology of that story again, but I don't actually think that she conjured up Samuel. I think she conjured up a familiar spirit. And the reason I say that is because the chapter right before says that God stopped speaking to Saul, period. He didn't speak to him through dreams. He didn't speak to him through prophets. He didn't speak to him at all. And then we have this story. And, of course, Saul dies through that event. So communication with the dead, obviously, is something that God says, don't do this. Don't go there. This is not the way of truth. So they that sit amongst the grave spend their nights keeping secret vigils. And again, remember, these are Jews. They that eat the flesh of pigs, whose pots hold broth of unclean meat. Again, it's breaking the Levitical law. You don't eat pig. Look at this one, verse 5. Who else? Those who say, keep away, don't come near me, for I'm too sacred for you. Imagine a culture, a people, saying to God, stay away, I'm too sacred for you. Question, do we do that today? And I don't mean as Christians, I mean as culture. Absolutely. In fact, this ripples through our entire culture where we want to develop a religion that's better than God's religion, quote unquote. We want a religion that's all-inclusive, that says everybody is good, everybody's okay, everybody is heading in the same direction. We want this all-inclusive religion. We want it to look good. We want it to feel good. We want it to be a happiness for all of us as people. We want there to be joy. We want there to be unity. And we're going to do it at the point of a gun. It's interesting to me that in culture today, there is this plethora of movies coming out that are, they describe dystopian cultures, right? A culture in which the culture somehow made a left turn into something very bad, where the government is totalitarian and is trying to enforce something upon the people, and it's their image of utopia. And so we have The Hunger Games, and we have Divergent, and I mean, there's just been, especially in science fiction circles, there's been these movies forever, but they're popular right now. And it is, again, it's intriguing to me what the answer is to these dystopian cultures. It's rebellion, and it's, we're going to replace it with something better. And I'm not sure that I've ever yet found the movie in which the rebellion has led to something better. So I'll give you a case in point. We watched last night a movie in which this dystopian culture had decided that it was best to live where everybody, every day, takes a drug, and the drug pushes down any emotions. And so, in other words, there's no love, there's no passion, there's no color, there's nothing that would evoke any kind of emotion. So there's no art, there's no music, there's no movies, nothing. We just all live in a very gray world in which nobody gets angry, nobody gets happy, but at the same time, there's no war. So here's my question for you. Is that the answer? And how would you respond to that as a Christian? If you could eliminate all war from our world, but the cost of that would be no emotion, would you do it? This is an ethical question for you. Why or why not? Okay. So this is where the movie was going. It's, you're not living. You're just propagating this bland existence for the sake of propagating the existence. There's no point in life without emotions. And that sounds good. But from a Christian point of view, that's not sufficient. Why? Well, no question about it. I mean, we are called to be in control of our emotions, right? Our emotions should never govern us. In other words, as a Christian man, a Christian woman, the Spirit of God should give me the power to be able to control my temper. So it's not that I don't get angry. It's that I get angry at the right things, but that anger then leads me to act in righteous ways. So again, I want to bring this back because I think this is important. What's the promise? What's the problem with the premise of the movie?
It is dealing with a symptom rather than the core issue. It's like, you know, the whole issue of global warming, right? Well, we need to change all this. Well, maybe that's not necessarily the issue, though, too. You know, or we just need to educate people better. Okay. That's still not going to change the hearts of people.
The real problem, absolutely, is that we are sinners. The real problem is not our emotion. It's never emotion. God is emotive. God creates emotion. But then he creates the power to control the emotion so that it can be properly governed, so that love can motivate us to act. But even our anger can motivate us to act in a righteous way. So emotions are chemical reactions in the brain, in a sense. They really are. At least that's how Dobson describes them. But they are God-given, and they are part of who we are. But just because, and this is the point of the movie, just because you take the emotions and you find a way to regulate them, there's still sin. You still have to have a police force in this movie to go shoot the guys who want to feel. So if you're caught with a record, you're caught with a movie, you're caught with colored wallpaper, you're shot. Because those would evoke emotions. Right? So the sin issue is the problem. And this is an important thing, because I'm all about trying to get to root issues, right? This is a really important thing for us to consider. In these dystopian cultures, we all want to rise up around the hero, and the hero is going to rebel and cause a new system to come into place. God is trying to make a point that the only real good system is a system in which sin is dealt with at its root level. And to me, that's an important thing that we as a culture, we miss. We miss this. So he goes on and he's talking about these things, about these people that are just completely rebelling against God, and that's why God's not moving. So verse 6, "See, it stands written before me. I will not keep silent. I will pay back in full," God's saying to these people, "and I'll pay it back into their laps, both your sin and the sins of your fathers, says the Lord, because they burn sacrifices on the mountains. They defiled me on the hills." So, you know, when he talks about the father's sin, he's not talking about generational curses here. He's saying, you remember, you're thinking back to those days when my power was manifested in the Exodus? You know, manna from heaven, the waters opening, the plagues. I showed my power there. But you know something? There were still people there that will die because of their sin. So what he's saying is, it's exactly the same today as it was back then. People who are sinning today will die because of their sin. People that sinned back then will die because of their sin. My power was manifested then, my power is manifested today. That's what he's driving home. That's what he's trying to get across. Verse 8. This is what the Lord says. "As when juice is still found in a cluster of grapes, and men say, 'Don't destroy it, there is yet some good in it,' so will I do in behalf of my servants. I won't destroy them all. I'll bring forth descendants from Jacob and from Judah, those who will possess my mountain. My chosen people will inherit them. There will my servants live." And so God makes this statement again. There is always a remnant. There's always a group of people that God has always had that won't bow to the knee of Baal, that will serve him even in despite difficult circumstances, hard problems. They'll still be there. They'll still serve him. He says that Sharon will become a pasture for flocks, the valley of Achor a resting place for herds, for my people who seek me. Now, I can't tell you a whole lot about these two places, but I can tell you a little bit. Sharon is over here. So again, remember, Philistia, the Philistines live along the coast. The Shephelah is this land between the coast and the mountains. Here it's Negev. In our English modern, it's Negev with a V at the end. It's the deserts in southern Israel. But along the coast here, it was known as the Plains of Sharon, and it is beautiful. It's lush, there's lots of green vegetation, there's lots of growth. In fact, God uses the term the Rose of Sharon to describe, I think anyway, his church. But that's in this area here, so very, very beautiful. It is, of course, on the far west side of Israel. Over here, just a little picture of it. On the far east side of Israel, we have Jericho. And you remember, of course, in the wanderings of Israel, they came first to Jericho. Right at Jericho, we have a terrible story of a guy by the name of Achan. And if you remember the story, Achan and his family are stoned to death for their sin at Jericho. Achan, where he is stoned, eventually becomes known as the Valley of Achor. So that's on the far east side of Israel. So just above the Dead Sea here, you can see right in that spot. That's a picture, a little bit of what it looks like today. Just as a side note, when you remember the story of the Good Samaritan, there was a man who was on the road from Jericho to Jerusalem. That is the road. That's what it looks like. So you can imagine, it's a road that rises up very steeply because Jericho is, of course, quite low geographically. And it rises up along this mountain chain, and it's a good place for thieves to hide. In fact, it was a very dangerous stretch of road. But that's it. You're so interested. Just keep in mind, then, we've got the far west side, where the Valley of Sharon, and the far east side, where we've got Achor. Two possibilities. God says that either he is going to bless the entire land of Israel from the east to the west, or from the west to the east. In other words, the entire breadth of the land. Or it may be he's going to bless the land that produces the best, right? That's where you want to live, is in Sharon if you can. And the place where it's very worst, which is Achor, this desolate place where Achan was killed. So either way, the point of the passage is, God says, I'm going to bless this land, the entirety of this land. And that's what he's driving at here with Sharon and Achor. But again, for those that will forsake me and forget my holy mountain, who spread a table for fortune and fill bowls mixed wine for destiny. Now the NIV has capitalized those two words, fortune and destiny. Why? Why is God against people who live for these? Maybe I could say it that way. Yeah, how is it an idol, though? Yeah. Yes. So it's like this. I'm living for Lady Luck. Why is that wrong? Yeah, Luck says this. Luck says that the entire universe is undeterministic. In other words, nobody knows what's going to happen, and it's a crapshoot. Whatever the dice, whatever comes up, comes up. That's how people live. But that's not the picture of God, is it? There is either luck or bad luck, good luck, bad luck, or there's God. But there is never the two. They cannot coexist. And so one becomes, in essence, I'm going to live life as if it doesn't matter, if it's all just, you know, random. My decisions here make no difference. Or I'm going to live life like I believe that there's a God, like it does matter. So there is no such thing as luck. And my wife will sometimes correct me if I walk in and say, oh, there's a lot of bad luck there. Oh, no. We don't live in luck. And it's even language that I would like to completely separate out of my own tongue, because it conveys an idea that life is cursed, or that it's all about this randomness. Well, it's not. So in this case, God is saying, don't live life that way. And then he goes on, of course, and describes why that displeases him. I'm not going to take any time to go down to the next number of verses here, but I do want to take you quickly to verse 17, and we'll just introduce this, and then we'll have to be done. He lays out, you know, this culture of a people who are praying and seeking the face of the dead and offering these false sacrifices and living life for luck. And then he says, let me describe for you now what life in my kingdom is going to be like. So he's comparing two kingdoms. Do we want to live over here where life is nothing more than this crapshoot, where it's all about the luck of the dice, the draw the card, whether or not it's good luck or bad luck, or do we want to live here where God has defined something for us? And we've been through these verses before, so I don't have to take a whole lot of time on them. I just want you to see now their context. It's the millennial passage that we've looked at. All the way from verse 17 down to verse 29, where the wolf and the lamb will feed together. The lion will eat straw like the ox. And, of course, we've got this great picture again, and the internet is just reeling with the number of pictures of what the millennium might look like. So let me, and again, you've seen this picture before, let me just suggest to you, in the Garden of Eden, there were four relationships that are spoken of. There's a relationship between people and God. And, of course, this is our North American representation of Jesus. There is a relationship between men to women, male to female. There's a relationship between humans and animals, and there's a relationship between humans and nature. So just a little bit of theology here, but this is important because Genesis 1 and 2 spells out these four relationships. Genesis 3, all of the relationships break. So let's look again. What's the relationship between humans to God? If you will eat of this tree, you will surely die. Physical death, yes. More importantly, the relationship between you and God says, will be shattered. It will be broken. I will have to restore it. You can't. The relationships to humans changed. Again, how is it manifested? Fig leaves? Okay. Right? What do? Immediately they clothe themselves, right? Because they are ashamed. So the relationship between Adam and Eve is broken at that point in time. There's a barrier there, represented first by fig leaves, later on by God killing an animal, shedding its blood, and clothing them in animal skins. Third relationship that's broken is from humans to animals. Why? Because God says, I will now put fear in the hearts of animals. They will be fearful of you. So there's an antagonistic relationship now. And then humanity to nature. Nature will now produce thorns, God says. You will work by the sweat of your brow. It's going to cost you something physically. In other words, from this point forward, you are going to have an antagonistic relationship with your creation. And we've been having that antagonistic relationship with creation ever since. Four relationships then that are shattered in the book of Genesis chapter 3. And again, these are important because the rest of the Bible speaks of how God fixes them, in essence. And they are all at God's impetus. It's all at His power. It's all at His control. He has to fix these because we cannot. We're powerless to do anything. So when we read in the book of Revelation, and we read about end time events, again, I just want you to remember some of this stuff. The relationship between humanity and God, war. Right? There's clearly, there is this cosmic events, human events. You know, the kings of the earth, the Bible says, they say, rocks fall on me because we don't want this presence of God in our lives. It's exactly what we saw in Pharaoh in the Exodus. The relationships in here, sort of men to women and men to men, well, Jesus makes this statement in Matthew 24. Nation rises up against nation. Fathers and sons will be at odds. That relationships, households will be split by this Messiah. So he makes it very clear that, again, there's this angst that it'll be everybody for themselves. Human to animal, again, if you remember the riders of the apocalypse, those four horsemen, makes that statement that even the natural creation will rise up against humanity, that animals will attack. And I don't know what that looks like. I have no idea. But it's clear, again, that this brokenness in the book of Revelation is manifests itself in this terrible way. And so we have, again, a relationship between humanity and the animal kingdom that's at war. And clearly, the human to nature, I mean, it's all the way through the book of Revelation, we have these natural catastrophes. So Revelation seems to be an amplification of this. Now, the millennium is a fixing of all of these. That's how I see it. So when we read about the millennium, God said, this is what your millennial kingdom looks like. And again, there's lots of theology wrapped up in this, but in a literal interpretation, behold, he says, verse 17, new heaven, new earth. In other words, I'm going to remake that which is broken. Former things will not be remembered. They'll not come to mind. In other words, the new kingdom will so surpass the old, we won't even want to think back here. We'll be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create. For I'll create a new Jerusalem to be a delight, its people a joy. So delightful and joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem. Get that? Not just the people will rejoice. God will rejoice. I will rejoice over Jerusalem. Take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and crying will be heard in it no more. Never again will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. He who dies at 100 will be thought of as a mere youth. So what is that a restoration of? Yeah, longevity, right? So if you die at 100 years of age and you're going to be considered a child, well, that's exactly what it was like in the Garden of Eden and just after that. So we get the oldest man recorded in scriptures, Methuselah, 969 years of age. Well, this millennium lasts 1,000 years. It's just a little bit longer than the oldest person that's ever lived. This tells me that infants will not be born dead. Right? An infant who lives but a few days. That's not going to happen. So this tells me something about the medical conditions in the millennial period. That it's going to be that which these medical problems that we have in birth today aren't going to exist. A person who dies, yet there we go. He still dies. So this is not a glorified people. This is an unglorified people. They're still living. And dying. Born, and he dies. Why does he die? Well, he'll be considered accursed. In other words, there will be a sin reason for death, but apparently not a physical reason for death. In other words, things that we hate with every fiber of our being today, like cancer, don't seem to be part of the millennial kingdom to me. It is a restoration of these four relationships. They will build houses and dwell in them. They'll plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. What this tells me is the productivity of the land will be such that you will be able to plant your own garden, and it will be sufficient for your needs. So the concept of having farms that are hundreds of acres wide doesn't exist anymore. I work for myself. I meet my own needs, which would remind me that the land itself will have to produce much more plentifully than it does today. That, again, is a restoration of the Garden of Eden. That's how the garden was before it was cursed. I love the fact that I work for nobody else. I mean, it's you're no longer working for the man, the government, the powers that be. That the fruit of your labors is manifested there. For as the days of a tree, so will be the days of my people. And again, longevity. My chosen ones will long enjoy the work of their hands. They won't toil in vain. It's not going to be a tornado that comes along and takes everything that you've built. The children are not doomed to misfortune. They'll be a people blessed of the Lord. They and their descendants with them. God says, I'm going to answer their prayer. Listen, before they call, I will answer. When they are still speaking, I will hear. In other words, Jehovah Shammah will be physically manifested. God says, I will hear even as you begin to pray. And then the wolf and the lamb will feed together. The lion will eat straw like an ox. Dust will be the serpent's food. That was predicted in Genesis. They will neither harm nor destroy, and all in my holy mountain. So if that's true, the very nature of animals is changed. So human to animal, animals are herbivores again, right? They eat straw. They lie together in ways that they don't physically today. Careful look at that passage, and you will find all four of these relationships healed. And that's at least in part the purpose of the millennium. So, Isaiah juxtaposes two kingdoms. This kingdom in which people are rejecting the Lord, they're living by fate, they're living by the crapshoot, whatever happens, happens. They're trying to communicate with the dead. He says, that's one possibility, but here's my kingdom. Which one will you choose? Thoughts on that? Time is gone. I gotta wrap up. Father, I know we've been down this road before, and this is probably just a little bit more review for us, but I think it's great for us to understand this millennial kingdom in the context that Isaiah presents it. We've looked, and I know which kingdom I want to be in. I'm not interested in being a kingdom that relies on luck and good fortune. I want to be in a kingdom that is based in reality, in your truth, in your word. I want to be like the wise men who are not afraid to journey wherever the journey takes them in order that they can find this kingdom. And I believe that my brothers and sisters here in this room today are just like that. This is what we desire. This is what we long for. So, Lord, even over this Christmas time that we're away, that we're with our loved ones, that we're celebrating your birth, I pray in Christ's name, continue to remind us this glorious nature of this kingdom to come. It's not manifested yet. This is a future thing. I believe that. But I also believe with all of my heart that you give us a little piece of this each and every day. And so, Father, through this Christmas time, would you fill our hearts with your joy, your peace? Would you build new relationships, new friendships in our lives? Would you heal those, Father, that may be struggling today? Would you restore that which the enemy would love to tear down? Would you just build it up? And Father, when we come back here together again in the new year, may we have a testimony on our lips that you've done something millennial, something incredible. And we bless you now for this in Christ's precious name.